Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is General Tim English. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being here.
Quite Rich, a promotion.
Yes, you deserve it. And General Britt Schramm. Hi, Britt.
Hey, Rob, Tim. Thanks for letting me on.
Absolutely. Again, thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it. We're here to talk about Season 6, Episode 18, Your Hit Parade. Before we get to the synopsis, again, you guys have both been on the show before, so we'll need to go into your histories with MASH. But as I've been asking everybody, as we've been kind of rolling through the season, Tim, let me start with you. What is your overall feelings about the Winchester years of MASH now that we're here?
I love Winchester. I mean, as you said on some of the episodes that you've released earlier, David Ogden Stiers was such a phenomenal addition to this cast. It did take a little while for them to find a rhythm with the character, but overall, I think Winchester's fantastic addition. And I'm really glad they didn't try to go with a carbon copy of Frank Burns, because it wouldn't work. And I feel like the Hawkeye needed an intellectual equal or greater competition. And Winchester's just the perfect addition.
Yeah, I feel the same. I mean, obviously, I think you've stated in previous podcasts, they made him a fully developed human, whereas, you know, Frank was definitely more quick ticks and, you know, more lusting after hot lips. So to have him in there, and even though they tried to put him in that romantic relationship, seeing that that didn't work, and having him move on, having him establishing a home life, you know, with his sister, et cetera, down the road, I really think they showed a lot of humanity in him, and seeing how a war could change even someone like Winchester, who came in very, very upper crust, very stiff. And you can see as the seasons progress how he kind of evolves into someone that wasn't who he was at the beginning of the series.
I mentioned in just the previous episode of MASHcast, like, how much people loved Winchester, like more than I would have expected. So as I mentioned, this is the 18th episode of the season, Your Hit Parade, originally aired January 24th, 1978, written by Ronnie Graham. We'll hear more about him in a moment, and directed by George Tyne. So after days and days of no wounded, the 477th is bored. Radar arranges for a batch of new records to arrive, and borrowing Winchester's record player, generously donated by Hawkeye and BJ, he begins to play them over the PA. The quiet is broken when not only do wounded arrive, but a ton of wounded arrive. So many that the swamp, the mess tent, and the officers' club are converted into post stops. Colonel Potter asks Radar to keep playing the records and acting as DJ to help them get through this push. Radar really gets into the role, donning hipster sunglasses and talking in an equally hip DJ style. This one's a mover and a groover, and it ain't by Herbert Hoover. Not only are they overloaded with patients, but one soldier desperately needs AB negative blood, which is exceedingly rare. They make some calls, and one guy in the bomb disposal unit has it. He's ordered to report to the 477th after he's done his R&R, and they have to make do until he arrives. He shows up in the middle of the night completely drunk, but even though he's falling off his feet hammered, when he sees the needle, he runs out to the compound screaming in terror. Hawkeye and BJ track him down in Margaret's tent, and when they finally get the needle in him, he passes out. With that small crisis over, so is the large one. All the patients have been tended to, and there's no more new wounded. Radar's marathon DJ sessions end around dawn after the 23rd playing of Sentimental Journey, all requested by Colonel Potter. So anyone who's seen this episode knows that is a very brief synopsis of what goes on. There's like 7 different plots going on in this particular episode. It's actually one of my favorites from this season. Overall, like, what are your feelings on Your Hit Parade?
It's good. I like it. I initially didn't remember it until I rewatched, and I was going, oh, okay, I remember a lot of the beats, and obviously the whole DJ record thing kind of getting into place and seeing how that integrated with the plot of trying to get this AB blood in. So it was one that, while, you know, and there's, like you said, there's a lot of other parts going along that maybe not all elevate all the way to like a B level, but they're like, you know, the interaction between, again, Houlihan and Winchester, the trying to find the bomb disposal person that has this blood, trying to see that how Winchester kind of is trying to find his way in the surgical staff, but we're trying to triage better. It's just, there's a lot of stuff going, a lot of richness that may not actually bubble all the way up to the top, you know, A or even B plot line, but still is there to help bring more to the story of MASH as it continues throughout the series, at least this season.
I'm going to agree with you, Rob. This is one of my favorites from this season. It's jam-packed with a whole bunch of different stuff going on and a lot of pop culture references that, as somebody who was born in the mid-80s, I actually understood through other different, you know, media, different media outlets. And we'll get to those as I made notes, but this is just a jam-packed episode with a lot going on that actually contributes really well to the overall story of the episode.
Reminds me a bit of the season 4 episode Deluge, which is just about a ton of wounded arrive. That's basically the plot. And then it spirals out from there with all the sub stories that episode has. And that's one of my all time favorites, probably like my top 10 favorite episodes of MASH. But this is that kind of thing. Now, this has that through line of Radar with the records and kind of providing the running commentary. But it's just a bunch of small plots all spun off from the idea that they are overloaded, that 477 can go from bored to, oh my God, we are so busy that the patients are literally being stacked up on the bar. And they would do something similar even in season 8 with Dreams, where they would get overloaded with wounded. Now that, of course, that show had a whole other concern going on, but they would do this every so often where it was just, okay, we are just going to pile on the wounded and see how the unit reacts. And so I always like those episodes because it's like, it's definitely the Grace Under Fire kind of thing. It opens up, the episode opens up in the swamp, and we see Hawkeye and BJ are playing a game that they have invented themselves called Cranko, which involves drunkenly mixing poker, checkers, and chess. And I got to say, MASH, up until the last year of the show, when it had the action figure line and the board game, all of which I have, and the play sets and the video, even the Atari video game, MASH didn't do a lot of merchandising. I really think 20th Century Fox missed a bet not making Cranko into a real game. I don't know what the rules would be, because there doesn't seem to be any rules, but
you have to be over 21 to start.
Absolutely.
So that may have been a problem for say Hasbro to
get. Maybe so. You couldn't stack it next to Clue or anything like that. Again, Hawkeye and BJ there doesn't seem to be any rules to this game. There's a great little inadvertent bit where BJ says or Hawkeye has to be kinged by BJ, and PJ pulls out a hammer and smacks the board as hard as he can. And one of the chess pieces flies in the air and bounces into BJ's martini glass. There's no way they could have planned that, but you see it land. And then in a moment, you'll see BJ reach over for his martini, and he just kind of does like a double take because he's now noticed that there's a chess piece sitting in his martini glass. There's no way you could, possibly arrange that shot. But Mike Farrell literally looks into his martini glass and tries to fish the piece out of there, which is just a great little detail.
Yeah, I was going to say, initially, I think Farrell, the actor, saw that it went in there. But as BJ, when he went to take the drink after the gin was poured, he pulled it out. And that's kind of where it was like, okay, how am I going to play off of this happenstance? How am I going to make it look funny?
I love that they left it in. I think that's great. Yeah. I think this is such a great, great deal. So like I said, I love Cranko. I love the name. It just sounds Cranko. It's just it's great, memorable name for whatever this thing is. So they're playing, and then Radar comes in and he explains that, he's got a bunch of, they've got a bunch of records coming in, except they don't have a record player on which to play them. And as I mentioned in the synopsis, Hawkeye, so gracefully and generously donates Winchester's record player for the cause. And we all know that Winchester is not generous. He's never really willing to part any of his stuff. At the same time, I would think a record player is pretty hard to come by, in this part of Korea, and especially as they would deal with some later episodes, phonograph needles. So I kind of get that Winchester would be a little pissed off about this, because kind of hard to fix this if it breaks.
Yeah, that kind of getting a record player in that kind of setting would be incredibly difficult. And I actually kind of felt bad for Winchester in that moment, because I, as a collector of old vinyl and even some current stuff, if somebody touched my vinyl collection or my record player without my consent, I would kill them. And I in this moment, you know, we all kind of have this, we all look at Hawkeye as kind of like a hero of the show and a hero to a lot of people in real life, myself included. But in this moment, being an ass and like sending off somebody's stuff without their permission, it's just like, calm down, it's not yours, don't touch it. And Winchester does get a little mad, you know, later on down the road, but boy, if he touched my record player without asking.
Good to also, know, Tim.
I'll have to admit as well, I'm also an avid vinyl collector, and to find fangs for the Tone Arm Cobra, I'm sure back then was probably hard to
incredibly difficult.
Yes. Oh God, I hate to we collect vinyl too. We are such cliches, guys. We're all three of us. But okay, yeah, we have a record player. We got one for our as a wedding gift, and we've been buying new records and some old ones. I've been buying my Bob Dylan on vinyl, even though I have his records on like 16 other formats. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So then we find Radar with said record player in his office. Somehow Klinger is seemingly showing Radar like how to get this set up, which since when does Klinger show Radar how to do any of this stuff? But okay, that's fine. And again, it underscores that it makes no sense in a couple seasons that when Klinger takes over for Radar, he doesn't seem to know how to operate this equipment when he seems to have been operating it pretty well for a couple of years at this point. We should point out that after most of the season not here, Radar's here. Radar's finally back from his extended R&R. Again, that must have been a sort of a contract thing that Berghoff had, that when he was in an episode, he got to do a lot. He wasn't just there briefly, like he actually sort of the focus of the episode. And the whole bit here is that Radar, when he's put behind a microphone to be a DJ, he freezes up. He can make announcements, he can do anything official, but when it comes to being a some sort of like personality DJ, he just absolutely clams up.
The first time I rewatched this episode at Radar, just because I'm sitting there watching it and my wife's sitting on the couch next to me, and I looked at her, I said, Radar touches that thing every day. Why is he afraid of it 6 seasons into the series now? Like, the writing didn't quite make sense. She's just like, seconds later, Radar says, I only say what other people write, not my own stuff. And I kind of understand that as far as, you know, being in front of the mic or behind my camera or whatever, that doesn't really bother me. I kind of looked at it as my size, where I'm consider myself a musician. I play in a band and we do a bunch of shows across Long Island, but for me, getting out in front of people doesn't bother me. So I kind of looked at it from that point of view. And then my wife was like, you got to look at it from his point of view. He writes or he reads what I-Corps is telling him to announce over the phone or over the PA or what have you. And it took me a couple episodes to kind of understand what Radar is afraid of. But it initially didn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, I could see that. And like I said, I could see Radar's point of that. Yeah, it's one thing to read, you know, I-Corps stuff, but then it's another thing to kind of try and be a personality and be interesting or whatever as he's spitting these records. So again, so he starts going, and then of course wounded arrive. Colonel Potter is out on the compound with Hawkeye, and he mentions that the 8055th has bugged out and the 8063rd is overloaded, and he says we're getting everybody's casualties, the whole enchilada. And so yeah, we see that all of a sudden, you know, they go from bored to completely overloaded. And I mentioned this episode is directed by George Tyne, who's done the show before. And this whole sequence is really terrifically staged. We have everybody on the compound. We have the wounded soldiers. We have people going by on litters. He really does put across, and he puts the camera kind of down near the ground because everyone is hunched over these soldiers. And you really do get a great sense of chaos. And Winchester takes a little too long on one patient, and Colonel Potter tells him to move, you know, and Radar stops playing the records, comes out on the compound, and Colonel Potter says, no, this is going to help us get through this. You got to go in there and play as many records as you can to give us a soundtrack to this whole thing. And just at that point, we hear the more choppers are coming. And that's when Colonel Potter makes the command decision that the swamp and the O Club and the mess tent are post-ops 2, 3, and 4 in that order. And again, we're setting the stage for, okay, absolute chaos, everybody. So it's a great, great way to open the episode.
My initial thought was, why use the swamp as another post-op spot when you have other buildings or another VIP tent that could be used? But it does, you know, kind of create like you said, the chaos for other events in this episode to consume, especially with the Winchester story and then him finding a place to sleep later on.
It's certainly not the cleanest place.
I was going to say the reputation precedes it as far as the name in and of itself. Obviously, I don't think they have too many other areas they probably could shoot from that would have that type of recognizability. Plus, then you don't get the whole all of the male officers congregating together to talk about a certain song.
The VIP tent is always full when they need it to be full. That's always how it works. It's somehow the VIP tent is, and you can probably put a lot of people in there because there's nobody lives in there, but it's always full when they need it to be full. So then we're in surgery and Radar is playing some music and BJ starts reminiscing that it's the theme to the Late Late Show, which he fondly remembers because that's what he used to watch when he was bottle feeding Aaron.
I think it does kind of speak to the janky timeline that MASH kind of inhibits because don't think the Late Late Show was all the way out in San Francisco. I think it was originated out of New York. And I don't know if they simulcast out there. it just goes to the fact that it's, you know, there's always going to be gaps in timelines because they didn't think people like me would actually go through and try to match up when Aaron was born, which was between July 5th and July 26th of 1951. And then when the actual premiere of the Late Late Show, which was around February 26, 1951. So again, splitting hairs, I guess.
Nice call with the dates there, Britt. So we see again, the tents are already filled up. We go to the mess tent. Klinger is bringing thermometers. He's checking on people. And we see that again, the mess tent is already full. Now, I don't know where do people eat? When this happens, where like they have to eat, whoever the cook is for this season, I don't know where he's, maybe they're eating outside or something like that. Klinger talks to a patient at one point, gives him a thermometer. He talks about that he painted measles on his face. And that patient is played by an actor named Bill Kux, K-U-X. He's had some interesting credits like Die Hard 3, Die Hard with a Vengeance, California Suite, and a 1970s softcore porn film called Sweater Girls, which sounds really fun. I love reading up these people's filmographies.
You had one a couple episodes ago that just went full on hardcore porn.
Oh, that's right. So Winchester is talking to a nurse. And he notices that the order for his medicine has got gravy mentioned in it because somehow the charts have been mixed in with the menu on the mess tent. Now, there's a menu for the mess tent? When did that start? When did they start doing fine dining? That's news to me.
I wouldn't call cube steak fine dining, but and the fact that it got mixed up and not caught until Winchester saw the chart was... I had a couple of nurses, you know, not see that.
I love the idea that the mess tent is like a restaurant where you can go out, you know, before you come in, there's like a thing in the front, like, so what we're serving today? is that really, what do they print that up every day? You know, this morning?
Maybe they haven't taken down the Shea Klinger sign.
Yeah, it was like, you know, okay, we're having powdered eggs and powdered milk and hash. And okay, well, that sounds good. So it's like, Shea Klinger. Then we go to the O Club and that is filled up with patients. Potter and Winchester are there. There's a, Potter, mentions that there's a song, Bless You and Keep You. And he's like, they're playing your song, Father. And Milk Mulcahy, he says, actually, I requested Tico Tico, but this is very nice also. And, most of these songs that you mentioned, Tim, that you knew a lot of these songs from context, most of these I did not know.
A few of them I've kind of, it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but for me, it's 6 degrees of Jimmy Buffett. as I may have mentioned before, your obsession with Bob Dylan, I have that same obsession with Jimmy Buffett.
Okay.
Tico Tico is a Brazilian folk song that was written or composed back in the early 1900s, but Carmen Miranda kind of made it a little bit of a pop hit a couple of years later. But I found that song because Jimmy Buffett has a song called They Don't Dance Like Carmen No More. So when I first really started to get into Jimmy Buffett in the early 2000s, he's kind of right before I really got into MASH. I went on this deep dive and tried to figure out who Carmen Miranda was so I could understand reference in the song. And then I found this song, Tico Tico, through that, my research of that song. So it kind of made sense to me where I heard Father Mulcahy say Tico Tico. It's like, I understand what he's talking about, actually, because it's not a song that you would think Father Mulcahy would request. It's very upbeat. It's very danceable. It's just a very fast tempo Brazilian folk song. It's fun to listen to.
I was going to say, I think the one he's referencing, at least, and again, I'm from a musical family. The Andrews Sisters did a cover of this in 1944.
That actually hit
the charts with English lyrics. So that's probably where Francis heard that from initially.
That makes total sense.
That makes more sense to, you know, from what you're saying now. But yeah, that was my route went down that Carmen Miranda route. It's still fun to listen to in both English and Brazilian, or Portuguese, rather.
Tim, when are you starting Parrotcast? When's that going to start? You're doing the songs of
As soon as I can find a co-host that wants to do it with me continuously. I kind of thought about doing something along the lines of what you do with Pod Dylan, but I don't know enough friends that love Jimmy Buffett enough to want to come on each song. But
gotcha.
I can sit there and talk about, you know, a couple of minutes, 5-10 minutes, but nobody wants to hear me drone on for 20 minutes and talk to myself about Jimmy Buffett.
I've seen him twice, so you could always reach out.
Hey, there we go.
Beautiful. Right. Let's do it.
This episode was totally worth it then, just doing it for that reason. Excellent. All right, cool. I'll be on. Can I be on the episode when, because Bob Dylan covered A Pirate Looks at 40. Okay, I'll be on that episode when you do that one. Okay, anyway, for everybody.
He did that with Joan Baez.
Yes. We have just birthed a new podcast, everybody. You heard it live here on the show.
Yep.
So we go back to the swamp, and Winchester is mad that he has to pull all his things out and he has to move into Potter's tent. He's bitching and moaning. Margaret says, you know what this is, Charles? And she starts rubbing her fingers. And he's like, what? She says, this is the world's smallest violin, and it's playing just for you. Now, maybe I'm wrong. I didn't know. I always thought that joke was more modern than this. Like, I mean, this is the 70s when they made the show, but presumably this was a reference that somebody could have made in the 1950s. I didn't know that. I thought this was something much more recent, the world's tiniest violin thing. I don't know. Have you guys, am I wrong? Was this a thing in the culture before then?
I mean, I did a little research to try to figure out, because I was the same way. Even as seeing it then, I was going, wow, that's even pretty upfront for the 70s. But yeah, that was actually done in the past, but I'm not sure to the extent of what Margaret was doing. So I'm not sure how contextualized it would be in the 50s, the mid early 50s, I guess, that someone would do that. But stranger things always circle around, so you never know.
Margaret did it. I was like, wow, okay, yeah, this is really kind of a hip joke, you know, for 1952. I love Winchester's reaction when she does that, and he says, and I thought you were different. I love that bit, that this is probably the last vestige of hope he had for her, that she was slightly, because she's a major and he's a major, that she was slightly more sophisticated. And we were learning over the course of the season that her entertainment runs more in kind of the Hawkeye BJ variety than Winchester's. And he's finally learning that. But I just love that he kind of sums up with, I thought you were different. And then, of course, Hawkeye walks in and says kind of a silly joke. And Winchester goes, you, I expected from, which, of course, Hawkeye has no idea what he's talking about. But I love that. I love that bit that Winchester's like, I really am alone here. Margaret's not on my side.
Yeah, he's an island unto himself in that regard.
Yeah.
And again, as we get closer and closer near the end of the series, you actually see them become more friends. More acceptance of each other. And I think that's also, I think that came from their personal relationship off screen comparison to what it is on screen.
Yeah, absolutely. We get a cut to Radar, working on the records. And that's where he mentions, I'm putting another record on once I get a new fang in the tone arm Cobra, which, is probably the best line in the show in its own way. Now, again, I don't know if that is a thing that the writers made up or that's a thing from the culture. The fang in the tone arm Cobra, but even Hawkeye is like, fang in the tone arm. Like, it's really, Radar is ODing on slang here. And then that's the act break. And then actually, when we come back, we see that Radar has fully adjusted into the role, where he's got a sort of Hawaiian shirt on with glasses and a pencil behind his ear. So he is now fully acclimated into his DJ persona.
That's right. Daddy-o's, mommy-o's, and Encio's from Big Daddy O'Reilly.
I just love this whole character arc with this episode for Radar. It just, once he kind of gets comfortable being that DJ, everything he says is just, it makes me laugh every single time, no matter how many times I watch this episode.
He plays a song called The Cincinnati Dancing Pig. I have no idea what that is, like what any of that means. Have you guys either heard of either one of you heard of that song?
I have not. And when prepping for this episode, I kind of went back and took a dive into some of the other musical references that were made. And this is one that I didn't get to, you know, time to look at it, but I've never heard of anything like that before.
I did look into it. The song was by Vic Damone.
I've heard of him, sure.
But it was actually a song originated by Red Foley, and it was more of a country song with more inflections as far as, like, more, I guess at that time it was more, you know, like banjo and more, you know, like a supposed to be in a barnyard, where Vic Damone just turned it into more of a glossy, you know, for the time, pop song.
Gotcha. Those three words just seem to be randomly put together. Cincinnati Dancing Pig. You know, none of them seem to have any connection to each other. So when I heard him, I was like, what the hell is that? What does that even mean? So Potter then requests a Sentimental Journey, which even at my young age, when I saw this episode for the first time, I was familiar with that song. I know it's kind of a code for old timey, and Radar, of course, doesn't want to play it. And Colonel Potter has to remind him that, he is the owner of this particular radio station, so he's going to play it. And, and we know that Radar doesn't want to play it. He wants to play what he's considering hip music. And he doesn't want to play some moldy oldie like Sentimental Journey, but of course Colonel Potter wants to hear it. Then we go to Colonel Potter's tent, and we see that they're trying to fit all three doctors into the tent. Hawkeye and BJ and Winchester. There's some great physical gags where they're trying to assemble the cots in this tiny little space. Hawkeye gets to do his classic Groucho Marx, room service, send up a larger room, that whole bit. And at one point, when they're Hawkeye and BJ are getting ready, Winchester just puts his cot down over their cots, and then they lay down and put their legs on Winchester's chest. And I love that Potter's like, all right, good night, guys. Like, he knows this is not going to stay this way. And then Winchester gets mad, grabs his cot, and walks out into the compound. Again, there's got to be more places for Winchester to put his cot than where he ends up, you know, in Margaret's tent in a moment. But for this moment, we're pretending that the camp is a lot smaller than it really is.
Yeah, there's no mention in this episode of the VIP tent that I had brought up before, and I can recall. I don't understand why that wasn't an option to be used for any of the stuff going on in the camp. But I really felt so bad for Winchester in this part of the episode for the last 48 hours, because I've watched it a few times over the last couple of days, and I was on a flight that got delayed by almost 9 hours, finally made it back home at 4 o'clock in the morning. So when I walked into the house, I had that same, like, just lean me up against the wall, I will sleep here, don't move me, I'm good. So the last couple of days, I really felt bad for Winchester not being able to find a sleep to lay down and take a nap or fall asleep or whatever. But it's a good little insight to how him and Margaret's relationship does eventually evolve. Because I love that when they do get into Margaret's tent, he says, "Let me be Frank," and they acknowledge that Winchester knows of Frank.
Yes, and we're going to get to that. Yep. But I would go sleep in the damn supply shed.
Yeah,
go sleep there.
Well, I mean, that's only for making out.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I guess so. There's a hanger on the door, which is indicating that people are busy in there. But yeah, there's lots of other play. Like, there's the dentist tent. We never see that. He's probably got space. I don't know. So,
with our magical fourth surgeon that doesn't seem to appear after Spirit Chunker.
Right. Yeah. The night team that we never see. Yeah. So. We're back in Potter's tent, and Radar starts playing Sentimental Journey. BJ and Hawkeye complain, oh God, again with this. And Potter says, well, there's a story attached to this, but I don't think I should tell you guys. And they're like, oh, come on. And he even said, Daddy, tell us a story. And he says, well, it reminds me of a very special lady. And they go, Mildred? And he goes, no, after Mildred. And okay. And then so Colonel Potter tells this story about when he was stationed at Fort Dix. He goes up to New York and to see Les Brown and his Band of Renown, which is the only way I ever knew who that was thanks to Colonel Potter. And he talks about going into, he's at the dance floor and he sees this absolute willowy blonde beauty, fell in love with her, and he didn't realize that the woman that he was looking at was in fact Doris Day. And it's because they were playing Sentimental Journey at the time that connects him up with this memory. First of all, I love all references to Colonel Potter as young Colonel Potter, the young Sherman Potter Chronicles, MASH spinoff show on Disney Plus. Let's get that going.
I think you can start writing that. You should start writing a pilot for
it. I guess I should with the writer's strike. I'm not in the union. I could just write it on spec and then sell it or something. I would never be a scab, everybody. That's just a joke. But the thing I think about when I hear this story, right? This is 1978 when this episode airs. Doris Day was alive. Doris Day was alive up until not all that long ago. She lived to be in her mid 90s. God bless her. And I always wonder, like, does this stuff get, like, this had to have gotten back to her. MASH was like the fifth most popular show on television if she didn't already just watch it herself. And I always wonder, like, how does that feel if you're like that famous? And then you're mentioned in a context like this. And it's very respectful. Obviously, Colonel Potter's talking about how gorgeous she is and that he's always loved her from afar. And he mentions, I've seen every Doris Day movie alone, you know, never with Mildred. But I would have loved to have heard if somebody was like, hey, Doris, did you watch MASH last night that he mentioned you on? I just think it's just so charming.
I
was going to say, it just, again, points to the timeline because the song Sentimental Journey was recorded in 1944. So basically, I don't know where we are in MASH time. So even if they're in 1952, mid-1952, that's only 8 years prior. So Colonel Potter aged a long time in those 8 years.
Well, yeah. you're right. That makes no sense that Colonel Potter was with the boys at Fort Dix when he was what, in his 40s?
Doris Day
hasn't been that famous for that long too by this point. Doris Day really debuted in sort of like the mid post-war era. She wasn't even, yeah, you're right. That doesn't really track at all, right?
No, but I wonder if going back to your comment about getting back to Doris Day, I wonder if somebody at that point when this episode aired with her being as famous as she was, if something like that might just kind of roll off somebody's back. Like, to me, I'm saying this is, you know, I'm not famous at all, but I would assume that they were used to somebody talking about them on television or news or other movies, something like that, and just kind of letting it roll off the back. But it would have been nice to kind of get her response to being mentioned on the show, because this is actually not the first time that I could recall of her being mentioned. And this is going back to my little deep dive I did of her, where there was another mention of a song that pertained to her back in season 2, I believe it was, Dear Dad 3. They're playing the song Making Whoopee in the Swamp with the Swedish nurse comes in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's talking about making Whoopee, or she's asking the Hawkeye what Whoopee means. And he's writing a letter to his dad and goes, I'll be with you in a moment. Doris Day actually recorded that song, later on too. So this is not, you know, this is like the second or third mention of Doris Day's music in this television series. So at this point, she might have been just like, oh, they did it again. Cool.
That's a good pull. That's a good pull, Tim. I forgot about that. I mean, I remember that scene. I didn't know that Doris Day recorded that, but yeah, I mean, yeah, it's entirely complimentary. I mean, it's about this guy that loves her and has seen all her movies. So, I mean, it's really sweet and warm hearted, and I just love that stuff. I'm just imagine somebody being like, hey, they mentioned you on like the most popular TV show in the country last night. Oh, yeah. Very nice of them. That's cool. So, all right.
I was just going to say, before we leave the song, I know Rob's, you know, other podcast, at least Pod Dylan, that Bob actually covered this song in 2017.
Yes, he did.
For his album Triplicate.
So, that's right.
Again, just another way to work your other podcast into this. Soon, The multiverse of Rod is coming closer and closer together.
Well, I think
crisis we've, at some point.
I think we've learned
synergy.
I think we've learned that box audiences don't like multiverses necessarily. So I don't think I want to do that. Maybe when it comes to Spider-Man, they do. But outside of that, maybe not. So I might be staying away from that. Everyone hears a commotion outside. They hear like a Jeep screech on, and they hear somebody yelling and realize that Winchester is sleeping out on the compound, which seems incredibly unsafe. And then we see that the guy in the Jeep is the bomb disposal expert who is here to bring the AB negative blood. This is Ronny Graham. This is the writer of our episode. And he had a long, long career before he ever got to MASH. And he had a long career after this run on MASH. He lived until 1999. He worked a lot with Mel Brooks. You've seen him in movies like History of the World Part 1, To Be or Not to Be, Spaceballs. But then not only did he write this episode, he went on to become a story consultant and program consultant through season 8. And he would end up with a lot of writing credits on the show. And this is the beginning of his run on the show. And even though the episodes were shown out of order, they obviously were, maybe Ronny Graham was working sort of unofficially or something like that. Or again, I don't exactly know the timeline of this. But it is Ronny Graham to whom Mike Farrell gives credit for coming up with the button on the joke in the Winchester tapes about where they're giving him the wrong size pants. And they said they needed a joke to get out of the scene. And he said it was Ronny Graham who came up with the line, starting tomorrow, he gets taller. So, more power to you, Ronny Graham, because that is a joke for the ages. We also get an appearance by Johnny Hamer as Sergeant Zale. And we see that this guy that they've picked up, the bomb disposal expert, is completely hammered. And they say they can't give him blood. They can't borrow his blood just yet because he's so drunk. I didn't know that. I didn't know that was like a thing. The doctors out there in the audience, if that sounds plausible, I didn't know that would make a difference. But basically they have to dry him out before they can tap him for blood.
I mean, I'm not the doctor, but I have seen it. In my years of being an EMT, if I remember my training correctly, it's been a couple of years since I've stopped being an EMT. I believe alcohol acts as kind of like a diuretic and a blood thinner, and they can correct me if I'm wrong. But that's kind of where my mind went to, is they can't take it because the blood platelets are too thin or whatever, and it wouldn't mix well with the blood that they're trying to put into this kid's body.
Oh. Okay.
Plus, they're not doing like spitting or anything like that. It's a straight transfusion. So, yeah. And again, I'm not a doctor either, but I have a feeling that plays part into it as well, as they can't separate and stuff like that.
So, that makes
sense.
Like I
said, I could be wrong, and if they want to comment and correct me, but if I remember my training, I think that would be my guess as to why they can't do it.
So. Okay. I bow to the superior wisdom. Yeah. Doctors Lewis and Ange, if that's not exactly right, let us know in the comments. But that makes total sense to me. Yeah, again, like you said, Britt, they're giving to him straight. They're not doing anything with it, so that might have something to do with it as well. So they cart him off. We then follow Winchester, and he makes his way into Margaret's tent, and he's begging to stay there. And she's like, she's of course having none of it because it would look improper. And that is when Winchester decides to say, "Margaret, on this occasion, allow me to be frank." And Margaret says, "Frank, I beg your pardon." And he goes, no, I didn't. I mean, Frank with the little F, I didn't mean that other Frank. And I think I might be wrong. This might be the only one of two references that Winchester will ever make to Frank Burns in this episode. And then he mentions at the time capsule episode, but I can't think of another time that Winchester has ever acknowledge that he is aware of the doctor that he has replaced.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that comes to mind, but I just absolutely love that for once in MASH's entire run, they're acknowledging something from another character other than you hear BJ reference Trapper, but Hawkeye tell the story of Trapper being there to BJ. Mm-hmm. But whereas we don't ever see anybody in the outfit talk about Frank in front of Winchester. But now there's a connection being made somewhere that Winchester does know of Frank Burns. And I think that's a really cool thing to see because it's not completely, you know, Frank's gone, yes, but it's not erasing Frank from the memory of the show still.
Yeah, somebody sat him down and told him. And yeah. Also, he knows that Frank had a relationship with Margaret because he gets her, you know, when she's like, Frank, I beg your pardon. Like, she's offended, and he realizes what he has just said, and he realizes why she would be offended. So, yeah, so somebody sat Winchester down and told him all about Frank Burns. And I, like you, I just love that. I love that idea that, okay, he's aware of Frank Burns' reputation. It's terrific. And of course, Margaret's not having any of it because she says she's a married woman. And Winchester, of course, is like, look, and I don't, there's nothing to do with it. I'm exhausted. But again, she's not having any of it because she just knows that would look improper.
Yeah, I think you hit on it before. We're back at the, you know, back in the 50s. For a man and a woman to be alone in a tent is very suspicious. But I totally understand where both of these characters are getting at. Charles just wants to sleep. And as I mentioned earlier, my experience over the last 48 hours with airplanes, I feel for Charles. I just want to sleep. That's it. And I really understand that. But on the same token, Margaret's got a point. Like, no, you're the opposite sex. We'll start talking. And as we see in a second, in a couple seconds, BJ and Hawkeye come in and start making jokes and comments to prove Margaret's point.
Right.
Like, exactly. I understand both, but Charles just wants to sleep. And Margaret's all worried about the chatter that will go on the scuttlebutt.
So we were back to the swamp, and Hawkeye and BJ are pouring coffee down the bomb disposal guy's throat. And they're like, four cups of coffee later, and he's even drunker. And, you know, from what I always understood about coffee and the wives' tale about that is that coffee doesn't make you less drunk. It just wakes you up. It doesn't, because, you know, if you drink too much, you get sleepy. But coffee doesn't reduce your drunkenness. It just makes you more alert, but you're also still drunk. But okay, I mean, again, that's still kind of the, you know, this is what the remedy presumably was in the thought in the 1950s. They lay him down on the cot, they pull out the needle, and he goes, oh, that's a needle. And BJ has a line about, oh, he is getting better. He's able to distinguish objects, which I think is great. They talk about like he's a baby. And then they say, you know, look, we're going to give you the needle. He says, no, you can't put a needle in me. I can't stand. I pass out. And they're like, oh, it's okay. You'll be lying down anyway. No, you don't understand. I really, really pass out, which is like, well, so what? That's fine. We can bleed you. Do either one of you guys, Britt, do you start with you? Do you, one of you guys have a problem with needles? I know people that do. I don't, but I know people that really get bothered by it.
No, I actually try to donate at least annually to the blood bank down here.
Outstanding.
I mean, this is a weird group of people. I think you mentioned on the images episode about the tattoos. I have tattoos, but I cannot watch somebody draw my own blood. I just can't do it. And I had knee surgery done a couple of years ago. And when they put the IV in me, I started to get all lightheaded and dizzy just because I actually watched them put it in. The tattoo gun and tattoos do not bother me. I love getting them. I love finding them out. But if somebody needs to take blood for the test, it's, to me, I get all antsy and all jittery. And then that kind of makes me feel a little lightheaded.
Okay, interesting. Is it the idea of the blood? I mean, I'm going to get too far into it, but the idea of the blood leaving you is what is kind of like just upsetting, because obviously you're getting a tattoo that's like 1,000 little pinpricks, right? That you can do.
Well, that's the thing. It's in my, when I first told my mom years ago that I was going to be an EMT, she's like, "You don't like blood." I said, "I don't like my own blood. I can watch other people bleed, but I do not like looking at my own blood. It freaks me out. Something that should be inside the body is coming out." And, I mean, I know that's kind of a silly rationale, but seeing somebody draw blood from me, just, it's wrong.
Gotcha. Oh, I knew somebody that couldn't stand to the point that they would like be screaming, like just absolutely. And, you know, they had to get blood drawn here and there, and they would be like, you had to literally like tie them down because they would just flip out so much.
I'm not that bad on the outside. Right. On the inside, I'm screaming a little bit. I'm like, okay, all right, do it quick. Now, let's go. But on the outside, I try to be as calm as possible. But
so, Well, I'm very brave of you to admit that. So. and Britt, good on you for donating blood regularly. Good on you. The world, we need blood. So the bomb disposal guy runs out. He sees the needle. He runs out of the tent and they have to chase him. He runs into Margaret's tent where Winchester still is. And of course, as you just pointed out, Tim, Hawkeye and BJ make exactly the kind of jokes that Margaret doesn't want, because then they're making jokes about innuendo. And at one point they're like, let's leave these two kids alone. And Hawkeye even goes like, makes like a kind of goonish sound effect. Poor Winchester. He storms out with his cot and he goes, maybe there is a good roof somewhere. I love the way that David Ogden Stier says roof. He says it as rough, which I just find just comically like very amusing.
Thick Bostonian accent.
Yeah.
There's a
good rough somewhere. then we are back into the swamp and they finally got the guy subdued. He's out and they're getting the blood into this patient. And Klinger talks about it's a shame that he's getting this clean, wholesome youth is getting blood from this stinking drunk. And he mentions they've got the patient stabilized. He's got a good blood pressure. And, everything actually has worked. And so Hawkeye goes to bed. Klinger kind of rounds him up and goes to bed. The patient wakes up. The patient's name is Harker. He's played by an actor named Ken Mickelman. He was in Vegas Vacation and TV shows like The West Wing and Grey's Anatomy. And he is still working to this day. He wakes up and talks to BJ. And BJ says, I just got one really tired doctor. Then the bomb disposal guy wakes up. He sees the bottle, follows the line from the bottle up into his arm and sees that there's blood going through it and then just completely passes out. Ronnie Graham as an actor, not subtle, right? The Ronnie Graham was swinging for the fences. Like, yeah. You know, MASH was cartoon. We've got a guy dressed up in the women's clothes, but Ronnie Graham is definitely more of the late period Mel Brooks movies, the kind of sort of thing. So it's probably good that he worked behind the scenes because I think even for MASH, he's a little big here.
It was a bit much, the fanning scene, but he does play a fantastic drunk.
He does. So then we're back to Radar. And Radar is playing Sentimental Journey, as he says, for the 23rd time. And Potter comes in and he says, you know what? I can't believe I'm going to say this. He stops. He says, look, everyone's kind of tired of the records. You did a great job. You got us through. I'm proud of you, son. But he says, I can say for the first time in 12 years, I am sick and tired of Doris Day. And he takes the record off the and puts it in the rack. And that's the end of our main act.
The handling of those records, I can't deal with.
No. I actually have that in my notes, too. just a little bit more gentle than that, please. These things are valuable.
Get some sleeves, please. That's all I'm at.
Yeah.
You're getting Potter. You're getting fingerprints all over the records. What are you doing, man?
Yep.
So we come back to the end scene, and we see that Hawkeye and BJ are teaching Colonel Potter the finer points of Cranko. And he's like, Colonel Potter is like, wait a minute. I got a full house. So you got a lousy pair of checkers. Plus the Knight 10 of Hearts has your bishop ready to convert. And he says to BJ, is he following the rules? What rules? And Potter's like, now it makes sense. When we do the pan out from this moment, you look closely and you will see that same chess piece is still in the martini glass that is sitting by Colonel Potter. So they must have just shot this all in one go, which makes total sense because you've got the board out and everything else. It's already lit and things like that. But yeah, so they just grabbed the martini glass, even with the chess piece in it, and just moved it over to the other side of the table. And then the bomb disposal expert, Sergeant Walter Gribble, great name, comes in and requests permission to leave. And he gives a salute and he starts walking out. And then he starts telling old war stories, even though nobody has asked him to. And he starts going on and on and on. And he's like, bomb disposal is only a highly technical and complex job, but a very dangerous one. He takes a swig of the martini and he drinks it. And then he asks for permission and he gulps it all the way down. And he says too much rice, which Like, okay. Hawkeye's kind of like, all right, whatever. And they can't get him to shut up. And then they realize, okay, this will do it. And Hawkeye's like, oh, you know what, Beej? I'm late for rounds. And he grabs this giant needle, this massive syringe. I don't even know what use this syringe would have to carry this much fluid in there. But good Lord, it's like a syringe you would give Frankenstein. I mean, it's just this gigantic thing. And Sergeant Gribble takes one look at it and storms off. And then Hawkeye says, Colonel, you owe me $17.12. We should go again. I think you're ready for triple Cranko. And that's the end of our episode, guys.
I will say that syringe is not to draw blood out, but I think it's big enough to where if you have, say, like tennis elbow, if you fluid in your body, you use it to pull it out.
I was going to comment on the size of that too. Yeah, I did notice how it was rather large, but I didn't know what it was for. So
makes total sense. Yeah. I mean, there's no fluid you could give somebody in that level that you would need, but it is even, I don't get bothered by needles as I just mentioned earlier, but if I saw that coming at me, yeah, that would be a bit intimidating. I'm like, good Lord, they're going to stab me to death with that thing. So, so that is your Hit Parade. I think it's a terrifically funny show. It's got, you know, everyone kind of has a little bit of business. Father McKay doesn't get much to do, but everybody else, Klinger kind of assumes, you know, he's kind of like the essential corpsman, and then Radar is doing his whole bit. And then we've got Potter and Doris Day and Margaret and Charles and Hawkeye and BJ and the bomb disposal guy. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in it. So I think it's a terrifically funny show with just a nice spine of the records being played and things like that. We never hear these records again. Maybe they got shipped back to I-Corps or something like that, or I doubt they got grandfathered into Winchester's collection. I don't think he wants the Cincinnati Dancing Pig or anything like that. But overall, like I said, I just think it's a really funny show. It's a really great episode. So, Brett, I want to start with you. Do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
Well, I mean, the last throwaway line that Radar has on his fans, the hot potatoes and mash land. The pun is always good for that. And then, of course, you know, a couple have already said about the fang in the tono and cobra. Just, I mean, again, all of his hip patter was spot on.
Tim, what about you?
I'm just going to have to second that. Like, I wrote all those down, and I pretty much said to go with either one of those things. All you hot potatoes in mash land, or becoming your way as soon as I put a new fang in the old Tonon Cobra, or even when he first signs on and says a big hello, you daddy-os and mommy-os and NCOs. Once Radar got comfortable doing that, it was such a fun thing to watch and see over the episode. And you really can't just choose one, I think.
It's fun to see a different side of Radar, you know, confident, yeah, braggadocio Radar, as opposed to the way he normally is. My favorite joke actually is another Radar line, but it's not when he's on air. I love it when Colonel Potter walks in and he says, you take requests, right? And Radar says, we don't have anything for World War One, sir. This is so condescending to him. I just thought, not even World War Two, World War One. Yeah. So, like, Radar is so rarely sarcastic in any respect, and is certainly never sarcastic to Colonel Potter. And he's not really being that here. He's actually kind of being relatively genuine, but he's also knocking Colonel Potter for his oldie request. So I just love the idea of, we don't have anything for World War One, sir. And Potter's like, bottle it. So it's a great bit. Radar, not much in this season at all, but when he was here, they gave him a lot to do. And this is a terrific episode for Gary Berghoff. So that is your Hit Parade. So guys, Brett, Tim, thank you so much for coming back on the show and being my guest with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks for having us back.
Absolutely. So again, we will looking forward to have you guys on come in the future season. So again, thank you both very much for being here.
I mean, if we're going to say where we are on the internet, and we're speaking of vinyl, I do have a vinyl page on Instagram where I throw up all my vinyl that I play. Just go to Happy Hour Vinyl and I'm there.
Very cool. Tim, you have anything you want to plug?
Not as of yet.
You're waiting for Paradise.
That's in the works. Yes. but I have other things coming down the pipeline that if you want to follow me on my personal stuff, The Real Tim English on Instagram or TEnglish47 on that awful website, Twitter. I have a few other musical things coming down the pipeline, but I'm just not quite ready to put them out there just yet.
Gotcha. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. You can leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts. I really would appreciate a 5-star review. That would be just terrific. You can follow the show on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked in a show of your choice. So big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Dan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, hey, Adam Ackerman, Lisa P, Laura Braun, Stephen Van Skyke, Michael Kelly, and Daryl Clark. So that's going to do it. We'll see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Don't look. $5 says that's Father Mulcahy.
Tim, get your radar.
You're on.
Come in.
Afternoon, sirs.
Ah, radar, you're the last person I wanted to see.
Oh, radar, old buddy, looking at you is like money in the bank.
All the other tents, they just say hello.